Hello and welcome to the PureMed Podcast special series Behind Diagnoses Patients. My name is Leah Sarah Pure and I am your host. Behind Diagnoses Patients aims to uplift patient voices, to share their insight and experiences navigating the healthcare system. It welcomes everyone from patient advocates, the chronically ill, the disabled, and those with rare diseases to offer suggestions for a more equitable world. On this episode, I'm pleased to welcome Angela Deeds. She was diagnosed with gastroparesis and has been living with a chronic illness for almost 20 years, both as a minor and now as an adult, learning how to navigate in a world and a healthcare system that often creates barriers to adequate care and quality of life. She is from Virginia and has a bachelor's degree in political science and a master's degree in early childhood special education. She has worked as an early childhood assistant, early childhood special education teacher, a caregiver, and a myriad of other jobs along the way. Since the onset of her gastroparesis about 3 years ago, she spends her time reading, walking, painting, crafting, and Hallmark movies. She is learning how to adapt to this new way of life that gastroparesis has given her, and searching for the moments of hope still in everyday life. Today, Angela, we are here for you to tell your story in a way that communicates the good and the bad of our healthcare system, your concerns and suggestions for a more equitable world. So I'd like for you to take it away and tell us about yourself, your story, and what inspired you to become a powerful patient advocate.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on the podcast, but also thank you for giving me the adjective of a powerful patient advocate. It's all very new to me, being a patient advocate. Well, in a lot of ways, I can speak from a position of privilege and power because I grew up in a like lower middle class family. My mother was a nurse, my aunt's a nurse, my grandmother's was a nurse. And I'm Caucasian. I am a woman. But again, Caucasian gives me a little bit leg up in that arena. However, that's just that I have the agency that a lot of people don't. And so I take real careful stock in that. I don't want to misrepresent anything. But because of my position and knowing what I know, it's easier for me to see where the disparities have been and maybe fight for others better than I fight for myself. I can advocate all day long for my friends, for other patients, for other people I talk to on Instagram through my handle, Hope's Still Here. But when it comes to my own health and my own life, I'm very not great at that. And I guess that probably starts because I was diagnosed chronically with a chronic illness in like 2001. So I was a minor. And so for me, I had to travel to get diagnosed, had to find a pediatric gastroenterologist. Again, I was blessed with my mom who knew where to go. She also, because of what her job was as a head nurse, her working really hard, 60 hours a week, it's not an easy job, but her doctors in her clinic, they became part, a few of them became like a second family. So, and they were general practitioners. So when I kept getting sick and I couldn't get well, it wasn't my GP or my PCP, my primary care physician, knew of adult illnesses that, hey, wait up, maybe this could be affecting the child. And I think that really helped, because sometimes you don't see that with pediatricians. You don't think of, oh, this is an adult illness. Maybe it's affecting her younger. And you've seen that in healthcare recently, is that there are more and more young girls, especially, being diagnosed with IBS, which is what I was originally diagnosed with irritable bowel syndrome. Number one, that makes me feel really sad for all those 12-year-old girls, because I was there. It's not fun being different in middle school and missing all that school. As a minor, my mom did a lot of the advocating for me. Now, I still went through some heavy stuff from middle school to high school and the transition to being an adult patient. Things that should not have occurred. I remember radiologist telling my mom I must have snuck behind her back and taken a sip of water. I was like, have you met my mother? She hasn't left me alone since midnight last night. Like, or just the trauma of having to have a CAT scan when you're 12. And it wasn't as quick and as nice, and there weren't as many contrasts that were tasteful. Taste had not a yuck taste to them. In 2001, that's improved some, but I'm telling you, they're not that much better. And the understanding of the techs and the radiologists to be like, oh, this isn't a 40-year-old person. This is a 15-year-old or a 16-year-old. So that kind of, those are the things that I noticed. And then I had things where my school system didn't understand that I had a medical condition, not anything that impacted my cognitive learning. And so being the first of kind of this wave of people being diagnosed with this kind of chronic illness earlier, that was hard. But as an adult, learning that I could stand on my own 2 feet and I needed to, that I was the adult patient, that was a learning curve. I had a great gastroenterologist at the time who owned the fact that me being 21 and having a first colonoscopy and a first upper EGD, that kind of sucks and it's not normal. And that is hard. And he was very forgiving of the moments where I felt triggered or I felt scared. Later to find out, I am diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, but for me, it's very, I've managed it well, and I have great counselors and a psychiatrist, but it's more these episodes, it's the collective, and he understood that certain smells or certain things, tastes or things could trigger me. So he was very helpful in that and understand that, hey, this is not going to work. We need to try a different way. At first, we'll get to the now part. And so I really learned to stand on my own 2 feet, to go into those appointments alone, feeling like someone was listening. So about 3 years ago, I started getting worse. Started having more symptoms. I started symptoms that didn't occur with IBS prior. And I was like, well, I just had my gallbladder taken out like 2 years before or a year before. It's like, it can't be that, because I had a little like uptick in symptoms before that, like before my surgery. And I thought that was my gallbladder. I was like, this is the time my family, every member of my family has gotten their gallbladder removed around this time of their life. So I'm like, okay, I can handle that. And that's where my education, mainly for my mother, was very helpful. Having grown up in a medical family, certain things weren't foreign. And so my heart goes out to those that are trying to learn it, learn the lingo and their chronic illness or their illness at the same time, because it's a very steep learning curve. And my dad also had chemo on and off for the majority of my life until he passed away when I was 19. So your brain just thinks differently. I mean, you're going to start, your brain thinks differently now because you made it through pre-med and med school. Now you're in med school. But so I was thinking, okay, I know my chronic illness. I know my thing. They already took out the gallbladder. What the frack, whatever is going on with my body? It's not normal. This isn't me. I know I have a chronic illness. I'm not denying that. And then I got met with kind of systemic walls repeatedly. Oh, it's just your IBS. Well, I don't pass out with IBS. That's not what I do. That's not one of the things. And my diet, I follow the diet that I've been following since I was 12, what we know works. I haven't cheated. I haven't done anything stupid. And then it was, oh, it's just your PTSD. And I was like, hold up, wait a minute. Now I know that there's a gut-brain connection and I'm fully aware of that and I own that. But you don't get to say that my mental health is the problem. That's not your discipline. That is what bugged me. I was like, you can't just blame something. If you're really concerned, then say, hey, have you spoken with your psychiatrist about this? And leave the conversation open for the response and be genuine and wanting to hear what they say. So I had to go to my psychiatrist and my counselor and have them multiple times repeat to my primary care physician, because I had changed, because people were retired. What life does, you have to find new doctors. So I had, what's great is that my psychiatrist, my counselor are more than willing to work with other doctors. They see it as only a positive. Now that's to be said, my counselor is a counselor. She does have her PhD. So she understands the importance of collaboration for our patients' whole body healing. And my psychiatrist is from Eastern Asian subcontinent kind of demographic. I don't know how to describe that. So the idea that the whole body is the treating the patient like the whole body, the different parts are the part of a whole kind of Ayurvedic kind of idea is not foreign to him. So he was all for talking to my doctors, no problem. And he did that, and he did it multiple times to make it clear to them and to the next tier of people that I would have to, that I kept having to see, okay, she's done everything that we've asked her to do with her PTSD. It's well handled. She speaks about her triggers. She works through them. This is physical, which puts the ball in your arena. I'm not trying to pass the buck because I can't help her if she's too sick to come in to see me. So I need you to do your job so I can do mine and this patient can get better. I'm paraphrasing. I have no idea what they said. But he kept, I know that they both were met with resistance. And that's what bugged me. I was like, well, if you're blaming it on something else, or you're saying it could be something else, then you need to talk to the person that's in charge of that system. If you're only going to focus on your avenue, if you're only focusing on gastroenterology, then, and you're thinking it might be linked to another part of the body, then you have to talk to the other part of the body, whoever's in charge of that. And that does not work right now. It just doesn't happen. And I wish I could say that it did, that everybody collaborates, like the Stand Up to Cancer Dream Team kind of thing, but they just don't. Stand Up to Cancer Dream Team is an exception to the rule. And I learned that the hard way these past 3 years. I have come up against pushing, saying, doctors, this isn't the same thing. I'm landing in the ER. They just sent me, I was in the ER, they had to give me fluids and this, and they did this scan and that scan. And like, I don't wind up in the ER. I have a pretty high pain tolerance. And then on the days where I'm like, I'm not going to the ER, but someone overrules me, whether it's my mother, my primary care physician who has really stepped up and been great, or say my sister's on a call with me and she's like, what is going on with you? If I get overruled in my home, that doesn't happen. We're real big on independence and autonomy in my house. So it was just constant. Okay, so I'll send you to here. Well, that doctor was a university level doctor. Again, it was actually the same university where I went when I was 12. So it's only like an hour and a half away from where I live. But it was a local, not local. It wasn't the highest level of university medical centers, but it wasn't the lowest. It was like probably mid-level. I don't know what you call that medical-wise. I had to learn a whole new language and started taking people with me into appointments, which made a lot of people very angry. Or just uncomfortable. And for me, I'm like, I'm coming from a place of I've been told I'm a liar or crazy or whatever for a year and a half, 2 years, 3 years. Make sure I hear what you're saying correctly. There's going to be another person in the room so that we can best get to the, so I can get better. If I misunderstand something, they're going to tell me. If it's my sister on the phone, if it's my mom, they're going to tell me I misunderstood something. And that just wasn't. They didn't say no, but they didn't like it. But I had an ace up my sleeve because I could say, hey, my psychiatrist and my counselor has advised me to do this. And I'm asking that I do this. And I knew that by being very explicit and very verbal, that there was little they could do to say no unless they wanted to fight. More of a fight than I was in. It's like, I'm tired. I feel like crap. They're going in with me so that I don't, you know, get really mad at you and we miss what the point is. And then I was met with physicians that were so focused on this is how it has to be. This has to be the problem. Your tests are coming back this way. This has to be a problem. And then not willing to budge when a medication or a treatment protocol that they tried to put me on made me worse. I had an adverse reaction. I'm highly reactive to antibiotics. It's not fun. I can't like take a normal Z-Pak when I get a sinus infection. That's the least annoying. But going into it, I'm like, y'all, they've tried every antibiotic on me. Unless you're going to pump it through an IV, my gut's going to hate it and it's going to rebel. And it does. Very loudly, very uncomfortably. Med students, open a book because I don't think you want the details right now. And they were so focused, laser focused on these ideas that they couldn't see that it wasn't working or there was another thing out there. And I was like, I don't know what the other thing is, but I know this isn't working. And so it took a lot of pushing and a lot of not giving up. And right around the time COVID hit, I got approval from my local gastroenterologist to go to Johns Hopkins, which is internationally known, one of the best in the world. And I knew to ask for Johns Hopkins because I had recently lost someone who had to go to Hopkins for chemo, a friend of a family friend. And I was like, I don't know where else to go. I've been to this hospital and then another hospital, and they were just as narrow-minded and focused and on what they do, not what the patient might need. I don't fit into a textbook. I don't fit into a box. My mom thinks it's a joke. She used to start laughing at it. You're not in the textbook. And to be fair, we're all real messy and complicated, and the organs are very messy and complicated and laying on top of each other. So in my head, I don't think anybody's in the textbook. That's her favorite joke. And so I was like, I don't know where to go. So we'll just shoot from the moon. I highly doubt they're going to let me in because the way Johns Hopkins does their thing, they have to meet, get all your information, decide if you're going to work with their team, the situation merits their team, or however they decide, or they have a physician who can help with this particular patient. And I was selected and I was seen. COVID kind of put a pause on that, which was really annoying. Because when you're chronically ill, you don't stop being chronically ill just because there's a worldwide pandemic. Actually, that could put you further at risk. Luckily, I have not gotten it. I'm knocking on wood. COVID could make things worse. Especially now that I know what's wrong. I'll get to that really quickly. But so things were kept being postponed, and having hospitals shut down was a big thing. And I'm just sitting here being like, what's another 5 pounds, 10 pounds? Like, can COVID be over already? I just need to go to the doctor. And eventually was seen, and I had to get a special test. It was a gastric emptying test that lasted over 4 or 5 days. It's kind of hazy in my brain how long it took, because it was hard. You go on a message board, the patients that are going through the test will tell you it's hard. They have trauma from, like, they can't eat eggs for years. And that's what you're given, the nuclear whatever, the nuclear medicine that the scan looks at. It's how they see in. They can't eat eggs for decades because of that one test. Because you were at the hospital the first day, 8 hours in a waiting room, and then pulled in to be tested every hour. It's a hard test. But here's the thing. From my knowledge, from what I was able to glean from listening into people, because I'm just a ears always open person, there are only 3 hospitals in the United States that I know do this version of gastric emptying. And that was the hospital that figured it out. That's the test I needed. It's definitely a God thing that I went to Hopkins, because they're 1 of 3, because the other is Cleveland Clinic and Mayo Clinic. I live on the East Coast. Hopkins, I can do. I have no idea how I would have made it to Cleveland, and God knows how hard I would have made it to Minnesota. We're not wealthy. My father was a chaplain and an executive director of a nonprofit. My mom was a nurse, an RN, her whole life. And what about those that can't crash on their sister's couch to get the test? And it's the one test that I needed improved, and I have gastroparesis. And if you look it up on the dictionary online, it says like a paralysis of the gut. It makes it sound all easy peasy, not a big deal. Yeah, it's a big deal. And I had no idea. I never expected this curveball. I had over 10 years of practice going to doctors, seeing multiple specialists just to keep my health in check. I had been seeing a gastroenterologist since I was 12. Seeing an intern, primary care physician, family physician, internal medicine person. When I turned 16, I started seeing an OBGYN to make sure that wasn't affecting things. When I lost my dad, I started seeing the counselor and the psychiatrist. When I turned like my mid to late 20s, I started seeing a psychiatrist. So going to multiple doctors was not new to me. Having people poke and prod me, it's annoying, but it wasn't new. But this is a whole nother thing. And what you can glean from it, from National Institutes of Health or verified sources, it was a curveball. And it took, when I actually got in to see the physician, because again, there was COVID regulation and there was some messed up protocol because I had to go on Medicaid. Okay, I think it's Cater Care, one of those. They were having the administration part of the hospital was having a snit fit over me being out of state Medicaid. I'm like, I just saw y'all. Can y'all please, they're telling you they need to see me. what do I need to do? And I was jumping through all the hoops, and my insurance, the K super overseer group was doing all they were supposed to do. And I'm just like, can y'all just, I don't have it in me anymore to fight y'all. Y'all talk to them, you talk to them, I'm tapping out. And I had to step away for a minute and be like, somebody else do it, because I don't have it. And so that was a mess. So when I went to see the physician, I was in charge of the gastroparesis patients. And he was nice. He and his fellow, who was postdoctoral, I believe. He was understanding. And he was old school, which means like, he wasn't, when I say old school, he reminded me of the doctors I grew up around, how their first practice or their dad's practice that led them to become a doctor was their dad would go from house to house and do house calls. I'm from an area in Virginia where there's a lot of country. So there were country doctors, not in my generation, but the generation before. So in the practice I grew up in, that's kind of the mentality they took. They cared about their patients. They knew their patients. They'd known their patients from, one of the doctors was from cradle to grave. He took care of the patient. I'm not really sure how he did that, but because that's longer than his lifespan. But that's basically the range of patients they saw. And they saw whole families. So I was really blessed with that. But then, I mean, honestly, all I can say is it was all red tape, all political almost. It reminded me of like a political organization, a bureaucracy, a medical bureaucracy that I was having to fight against. And doctors who were less inclined to function as what I understand of a doctor, a Hippocratic oath, understanding if this doesn't work, let's try something else, kind of let's think outside the box, let's understand that this person might be a little different. So it wasn't until about a month ago, 2 months ago, that I found a doctor who listened to me, knew about what I was facing, knew how much of a life change it is, because it is. Your main nutrition is liquid. There's no way to cure it, and you're hoping for a plateau. You're just hoping to like find a middle ground. And they're going to be watching you, and you're going to have to be watching yourself for different things, your cardiac function, your nutrition levels, your fluid levels for the rest of time. And he understood that. And he understood that I'd been through the ringer. I didn't like the smell of the hospital. Not that you can open up a window, but I think he turned on a fan. I literally sat there shocked. It took me a day to comprehend that he was a nice doctor, let alone what he had just told me about what my new life was going to look like. And that's just not okay. And here's the thing. My story is probably the least scary of others in comparison. I mean, it's apples and oranges. My story is still really hard. But like I said, I speak from a position, a little bit of, in the medical system, I have a little bit of a leg up because I am Caucasian. Because I grew up around the medical profession. Now, I'm not in the medical profession. I don't have that level of understanding. But I grew up around it, so I know who to ask. It was incredibly difficult and incredibly hard. And it didn't have to be. And that's for me. I was blessed to have a sister that lived near Johns Hopkins-ish. Yes, it blew my mind. Now, considering my mind's blown anyway with this diagnosis that I now have, and like my mom's old school nurse, RNs, and the family's like, I think you may have had this all along, but since you were 12 when it started, there's no way to know. Because they weren't going to do a 4-day study on a 12-year-old. That just probably wasn't available back then in 2001. But this doctor is open to patient first. So how can we best support the patient while managing this weird illness that I'm studying in multiple clinical trials? So I want to know all I want to know. I want to know everything about this patient's life so I can put it in the clinical trial. But we're going to go with planned methods of treatment. And if she's not okay with it, we're not going there. And what I'm telling her is hard. But it's physical. I think the most shocking thing that came out of his mouth was these physical issues and these physical changes that you're having to make will have a psychological impact. It's hard to be told you can have to go from eating chicken and come from the South, so barbecue is a thing. Like, it's a big deal. My parents are from North Carolina. It's a big deal about barbecue. And then to be told, well, no, you're going to be eating mostly smoothies and a lot of really lean meat, a lot of small meals, a lot of, you're going to have to, like, I have Good Start Essentials, high protein. So it's like a milk drink. I use lactate because I'm lactose intolerant, but I mix that powder within the, and you're going to have to blend it up really well because the textures will bother you and all these things that factor into my daily life. Like the idea of putting a partner with that. When I find that partner, they're going to have to know that that's life. And if I don't do that, it's me losing another 30 pounds or 40 pounds. And that's really dangerous. And it happens really fast. And if they don't keep an eye on my cardiac health and so on, so on, that just plays in your brain anyway. And he was like, but it's physical. Yes, there's a psychological brain stomach barrier is very clear. But you have a physical ailment that will impact you psychologically in your life, but it's physical. It took me probably over 3 years to hear that from a medical physician who wasn't in the psychiatric field or counseling field. I don't think it should have taken that long for them to realize she lost 30 pounds in a month and a half. That's not normal, and she didn't do it on purpose. She's passing out in a public place. That's not me. I don't do that. None of my family history had that. And I know my family history isn't awesome. I had a dad with cancer. My mom has autoimmune disorders. I'm not trying to ask for a pill mill or jump the line. I'm not. I'm just asking to live. I've got two nephews and a niece I would like to be around. And I don't like living. So the idea that because I was chronically ill became a barrier. And yes, being a woman in a medical practice as a patient became a barrier. Luckily, my OBGYN that I have now did every test they thought needed to be run, even though he was like, no. I just did an endoscopy like 3 years ago, 4 years ago. There's no sign of that. This girl's checked all the boxes. You need to do your job. He was so nice to me about it. And hopefully I'm on the beginning of the other side of all this. But if I didn't have medical trauma before, and given I have that vocabulary, that's another thing in my corner, but I didn't have that before. I had to work for it. And I don't think a lot of medical personnel understand that. The vocabulary that, yes, some of it I had gleaned and got through osmosis when I was growing up, but it was very minimal. Just like what I needed to know when I needed to know it until I became an adult with a chronic illness. because my mom wanted me to be a kid. And that's what my dad wanted. And that's, he tried so hard to keep that part of his life away from us. And so what I'm having to learn and the vocabulary I'm having to develop since the PTSD diagnosis, since being an adult with a chronic illness to having gastroparesis, which is a rare disorder if you're not diabetic. I'm not diabetic. It wasn't on the screen of things that it could possibly be. I get it. I'm weird. My whole family's weird. We know. That doesn't mean we don't deserve good treatment. And for you to give a damn. And that sounds really coarse and kind of just cussed. I'm sorry. But I'm not less than because I'm special. And if my grandmother, who was educated during the war, in World War II, that's how she got her nursing license, that generation can look at me. She's looked at me and said, don't believe your cousins are ever going to really understand what this costs you in a life. But you are working for your life, and it's going to be a good one. It doesn't matter what you have. You're just proving to the doctors how special you are. And I knew this all along. But she's had my back. I mean, she still has it, and she's 98 years old or something, and not really sure where she is. So, but she still asks and calls about me. And I'm like, if that's a nurse educated in 1940-something, late 40s, where's the disconnect? Why am I hitting so many brick walls? And then to me, I have a bachelor's in political science. So for me, I automatically think, and I have a master's in special education. So I automatically think back to my students when I taught. I can't teach anymore. Can never teach again. So that's a whole career gone. But I'm running out of time. Sorry. When I can get a second to take a breath, one of my go-tos to not focus in on what's going on in me is to think about the other people in the waiting room or the people I've come across in my life, those kids that I would help, I would teach, and their parents. I'm like, I'm pretty strong. My family's weathered a few storms. I don't like this. I hate this. And most days I don't know how I do it. I'm just going to this step and that step and one step at a time. And you're being mean to me. You're being rude and unprofessional and clearly have forgotten your oath. What about, I get angry when I think about my students, honestly. I'm like, if you're mean to them, I'm coming for you. I'm not that confrontational. I'm really not, but not to scare the med students. I'm really not. But it just hurts. I'm like, it hurt me to my core. I'm tired. I'm exhausted. And that's before I have to handle all the gastroparesis changes. But I have a leg up in so many ways. And I got out of politics because I didn't like it. I didn't like the bureaucracy and, lack of a better term, the BS. When you forgot it, the government kind of like, the government agencies would forget the people that needed what they were providing, what they said they would provide. There are people on the end of those programs. And I hate to say it because I don't want it to be true. I don't think the medical profession thinks of it that way anymore. It's so monopolized. There are so many huge conglomerates that own every doctor in a city, or almost every doctor in a city. Like getting to a tertiary level provider, which is what I needed to survive and get the test I needed. Just to get the test I needed to go to them. Just was incredible in the worst form. And I was like, I got out of politics. I don't like the game. And I'm having to play the game. And at least I had an idea of what the game might look like. Now, one medical institution, I didn't know the game. Then I realized I had no idea. And I had to learn, but it was a harsh awakening. And then it was also like, if this is this hard for me, what about the mom who works three jobs to put food on the table and her child has a developmental delay, which is what I was a preschool special ed teacher. Yeah, this ain't cool. And at least I can say that. But there is like hope. I don't want to be like banging on the medical professional the whole time you have me on here, but I do have a few people in my corner. Doctors who think of the whole body as one system. That's why I like Deepak Chopra. I'm so glad he became the global figure he did, because he paved a road of mainstream. Yeah, he went in mainstream media. But the idea that your body works as a whole system, it's not that new anymore. It's not like, oh, you can't touch that. Oh, maybe it does. And maybe I should listen to the patient, because guess what? She knows her body better than anybody else. She's lived in it for 32 years. What I'm telling you is not normal. My degree of normal is very different. So some healthy, typically developed person and me is very different, I understand. But my different has gone nuts. And there are physicians that understood that. They were few and very far between. They were a psychiatrist, a counselor, a primary care physician, ER doctor, and then Hopkins. But I just want them to open their minds and remember the basis of that oath. I have a doctor friend who I've called many times and emailed and been like, what is this? How do I do this? He just wrote a book. He wrote a book a couple years ago called Chasing My Cure, Dr. David Fagenbaum. And he thinks out of the box because he had to. He nearly died a number of times. And so finding his cure was a hard thing to do. But he had to keep his mind open. And I just wish that there were more people like that. I don't need you to be as smart as him, because I don't know where he came from. It's like Superman came from a different planet, kind of smart. But I just wish that they were more open and that they understood the power of that oath. What do no harm means. When you're calling me crazy, when you're blaming it on my trauma, but you don't know what that trauma is, or you don't know how hard I've worked in the therapies I've done, you haven't looked at my little, I carry around a little chronic illness, what is it called? Medical treatment log. If you haven't looked at it, whereas your nurses love it because they don't have to like hear me go on about what medications I'm on, they just have to look at the page. But if you haven't even looked at it, to know I've been through X, Y, and Z, and I've got a clean, I'm on the protocol as it seems. Don't call me crazy. And your wording, just shy of crazy, is still crazy. And I just babbled for like 50 minutes.
Not at all. Angela, thank you so much for going into detail. I think you've already touched upon so many of the questions that I had for you. But the next question that I have for you is, what matters to you when interacting with health professionals or undergoing invasive examinations?
Communication. And that goes both ways. Hear what I'm saying. Say what you mean. Say what you're doing. Explain the reason why I need such a test. then I'm on board. If I understand the relevance and the one night I was in the ER and I had a panic attack. I was in the middle of having a panic attack, but they needed to get a CT scan done. So I needed to drink the solution. And I was like, this thing happened tonight, I can't. But then when they explained the importance of it, and the doctor was so kind and caring and understanding of the fact that I was very anxious and panicking, because I felt like I wasn't meeting their goal, what they needed. I felt like I was screwing up the process. I wasn't being a good little patient. And once that burden was taken off of me, they gave me time to take a step back, ground myself, realized, okay, I can do this. I've done a number of them. Let's get this done. They got it done, in and out of there, not a problem. But it was that communication and that willingness to be vulnerable with your patient and say, I understand this is really hard, and to be genuine in how you say that. I believed her. Now, I've had doctors say, I understand this is hard, and I don't believe them because they don't mean it. I'm sorry, but human beings can tell when you're lying. Especially human beings that have to be in doctor's offices a lot, you learn how to read the cues. You just do. So I can't imagine how difficult it is to remain a human being, feeling all your feelings, and be a doctor at the same time, understanding that kind of balance. Can't imagine how hard that is when you're dealing with people's lives and how you have to walk that tightrope. And my more power to you, if that is your calling. But in walking that tightrope and admitting you're human and saying, hey, okay, this is what I'm about to do and this is why I'm doing it. Okay. Or this is going to apply pressure. So I'm not like stunned when all of a sudden there's a shot going into my arm. I'm not afraid of needles, but I don't like to see them. So if I turn my head and then you give me like a half second cue, I'm like, okay. Really listening. I mean, the veins in my arm are shot. So when the nurses listen and they take it out of my hand, their job's easier and my life is easier. I don't walk around with a baseball sized bruise on my arm. And you haven't taken what you would have seen for patients, the time you would have seen four patients, and just to get the blood from one. So keeping that communication honest and open and that safety, that creates a level of safety where the patient who's already in a vulnerable position can be vulnerable safely. To feel safe is paramount. And the best way I know how to do that, because I'm not all-knowing, is to talk. I know you have tons of patients. I know I am not your only patient today. If you can give me 5 minutes of where you're focusing on me, and you're really present, I'll be in and out of here and you're the least headache, like the least headachey of the day, other than my special bonus features. Like, I understand that. So we're just on the same playing field. You're the expert I'm trying to learn from. I can feel safe. You can feel safe. And we're communicating. And that's just the basis of it.
And then the next question that I have for you, Angela, is how can patients ensure that they feel respected, heard, and understood, and that clinicians actually treat them like human beings?
I mean, that's really hard because when you're chronically ill and so you're not feeling great, or you've had to pre-med to go to a doctor's office, so you have this sense of foreboding in your head that something's going to happen after. A lot of times when I do that, I get in a place where I'm like, I'm the one who's ill. Why do I have to put in the effort? Holy crap, why do I have to put in the effort here? And again, I feel like that's where someone needs to come, like, meet me, offer me, like, their middle ground. And I'll get there. So for patients, it's being open to know that you're going to be uncomfortable. You're going to be unsure. But if you can communicate with your clinician, say that. Just say, you know, this has been a really symptomy day, or I've had this or that today, so I pre-medded to be here. So your doctor knows what's costing you to be in the room. And then I go into a doctor's office and I have my medical treatment log, so I can help them understand my clinical picture easier because it's on paper. It's not on my phone. Sometimes that's not helpful. I can just show them this notebook and be like, these are the meds I'm on. These are what I'm allergic to. This is what the last doctor said. If you want to look that far back, you can. They don't. But, and then I always, always write down your questions before you go in. Which, again, requires the doctor to meet you halfway and be open to looking at your list of questions. And the last doctor I had was great about it. I mean, he legit went through the questions. Awesome. I was not expecting that. But having an idea of your own, even if they don't look at it, knowing what your concerns are ahead of time, so that when you're in that environment where it's already so charged, you don't feel well, you're operating from a negative kind of atmosphere, at least the pressure is off you to try and remember everything that's happened. If you just run to the bathroom, now you're back in the clinic, so at the doctor's office, it's really hard to remember what you're trying to tell him, other than you need to tell him what just happened. But also, the best thing I can say is to come prepared and to be open and willing to meet them halfway, which means you're willing to learn, you're willing to talk, you're willing to admit you don't have the answers, and to be understanding when they're trying to find them, because they are having to find them. And that you're open to being vulnerable. It's not automatically going to protect, to fight, flight, or freeze, that you have to like sit in that space and allow yourself to be there. So I would say just try and be as open as possible and as prepared. I over-prepare. That's just my nature, but that's the best way.
Those are great tips, Angela, for any patients that are listening in or hearing your story, or individuals that you've even just inspired. And although this is going to be a loaded question now, I want to ask you if there is anything that can be done to improve the healthcare system. In your opinion, what would that be?
There's an episode of The West Wing where there's a patient that needs being flown to the States for some kind of transplant, and there are international hoopla over it because the guy's dad, it's a little boy, is not a good person, and we'll just leave it at that. But so the complications thereof. And the doctor that would have to, there were complications with the doctor that was going to have to do the surgery. But when the president tells his wife, who is a physician, the situation, she says, you treat the leg. And that speaks kind of volumes, because it means you treat the patient in front of you. You may not get along all the time. You may be having a shitty day. Sorry. They may be having a horrible day. You may not understand them. You may not understand where they come from, the kind of environment they come from. One, that's your job to educate yourself on the community you're in. Whatever that demographic is, that's your job to do. whether that's your community, like you can identify with that or not, there's whatever it is, racial, ethnic, the whole list goes on. Like you don't have to have a chronic illness to relate to me. You just have to be empathetic. So there's that. But what she said about you treat the leg is a reference to when the doctor treated John Wilkes Booth's leg. And he went to prison for 5 years until he realized he wasn't a co-conspirator in Lincoln's assassination, but he followed his Hippocratic oath. A man walked into his house at the time, walked into his office with a broken leg. So he set the leg. And as much as little as I know of the medical system, if you can get to that position where you treat the patient in front of you, you're not thinking about the patient behind or the patient ahead. You are treating the person, the patient in front of you, and you treat the patient. That kind of empathetic, very present kind of care is seriously lacking. I know I've heard of doctors that have come in with serious chips on their shoulder that don't even take into consideration that patient's needs or that what that patient's coming from. And we can get super political over like a rape victim being told she can't have an abortion or something like that, not understanding the trauma or the event that put that person in that chair and not having empathy for that place. But it's not even that political size, whatever their word is. It's there's a patient in the chair. Whether they look like you, they don't look like you, they think like you do, they don't think like you do, it doesn't matter. They're coming to you, they're trusting you to give them a physical, to do something really basic. They just want you to care that they're healthy or that they lost the 10 pounds you told them to lose or asked them to lose. You treat the patient and you do no harm. But also the healthcare system has to change to where the doctors and nurses are allowed the time and the space for themselves to do that. We are asking people to do Herculean type efforts without the support that they need. And I'm a daughter of a nurse. My mom was like supposed to work 40 hours a week. But because she was clinical coordinator, she worked like 50, 60 hours a week. We hated the way my mom had to retire. We hated it because of her, one of her autoimmune diseases. Flippin' hate that thing. But I was more than ecstatic. She was out of that system that did not care how much she fought to be back in that job or how much her children grew up doing their homework in the back office or in the lounge because my dad had an evening meeting. Or we were sort of latchkey kids. But being of service to her, because she's very service-oriented, and then having a business-minded individual tell her that that service isn't enough or isn't good enough. Not, I have a huge problem with that. But I come from, I'm a daughter of a medical professional. What nurses and doctors are doing now, especially in hospitals, especially what's going on in the world right now, it is way past time that we give them the support, meaning emotional counseling, better staffing, better pay. I don't know why the person who owns Amazon gets like, makes like, $1 billion for a day when there's a doctor who just saved 50 lives and he's working a 14-hour shift and he's uber specialized in whatever field he's in, why he doesn't get the same amount of pay and the same amount of respect and the same, and the nurses, for me, it's the nurses. It always comes back to the little guy. Why the custodian isn't getting more time to do his rounds or the security guard, or the simple RN, LN stuff. Let them have the time to do the job that they want to do. I firmly believe there are physicians, nurses, janitorial staff at these hospitals that honestly want to be a service. That's why they went into the job. Because of some MBA bureaucratic monopoly, they're not allowed the time. They're not allowed the respect to do that. And that stretches multitudes. It's even like, we all need to ante up. Yes, I'm asking the doctors to treat a patient. To treat the patient in front of you. Yeah, fix the leg. I'm asking all of us to give doctors, nurses, whoever, the respect and the time to do their job. But I'm also asking us as a whole to go and get the vaccine so they're not having to do like what they had to do last winter. That shows a great deal of respect for what they do. They're not living at the hospital because they're quarantined from their families again. So I just wish that the people that are in charge of the bureaucracy understood what they're trying to rule over, essentially. It's like that. I mean, honestly, that's what it is. You have a bunch of people who have no idea about the medical field running the medical field.
100%.
And they didn't have to take the oath.
I completely understand and I resonate with you, Angela. And I don't know how to tell you, but everything you've said is 100% on point in terms of bringing back that humanism, that care, the lost patient focus that is there in medicine these days. But if there is anyone wanting to share their story and too afraid or feeling alone or feeling scared or just not okay sharing their story, what would you say to them?
It's hard. From my perspective, living this life, not being able to teach again, being told I may or may not be medically advised to have kids again, kids ever, being called crazy in places where I thought I was safe. I came from an office where I knew I was safe with those people. They weren't going to judge me. They would believe me. They loved me. They cared about me. And even my current office, they may not love me and know everything about me, but they at least care. I know they care. My primary care physician right now, I know she cares. I can feel it. So to go from that kind of office to an office where I feel attacked and gaslit, it's hard. So sit with that. Own that in your own time. Own your bruises, you're being poked and prodded, own those scars. But I understand that those scars are what make you a badass and what make you stronger. And honestly, I started speaking because my friend kind of dared me to do it. A couple of years ago, she dared me to say something authentic every day on Instagram, how I was feeling. Just one thing. Most of the time it was a meme or a repost from somebody else. More recently, it's been my own content, but each time I put it out there, I'm terrified. This isn't comfortable with what I'm doing right now. It goes against my wiring to rail on the medical system. The word malpractice is a dirty word in my household growing up. Like, this is not comfortable. But each time I say my piece and I say my truth, I get a little braver, and I get a little stronger, and I get more peace. And at the end of the day, I'm over the moon if it helps somebody else. God knows I'm so grateful if it helps somebody else. But it's out of my head, and it's a weight off my heart. And I feel lighter because it's there. It's not in me anymore. I'm not the only one carrying it. I'm not carrying it at all anymore. I've said my truth. Take it or leave it. What I've said today is how I feel and my experience. And you're going to be scared. You're going to be given 100 reasons why. I mean, I'm from the South. We don't air our dirty laundry on the front porch kind of mentality. But all those reasons kind of matter less when at the end of when you're done, you're like, it's true. That sucks. But also, the positives are great. What I just said that was good, that stays in my head. And what I said it was bad is I kind of set it free. And it no longer has power over me. And if I can give someone peace about speaking their truth, that's what it is. You're going to give yourself your own peace. And it'll be hard. Some level of hard or uncomfortable every time. If you're doing it genuinely and authentically. And you're going to mince your words and accidentally cuss. It's going to happen. You're going to go on for 30 minutes when you meant to speak for 10. I'm not perfect. It ain't going to be perfect. But you will gain more than you will ever understand by doing it. And it's corny to say, but if sharing my horror story of the past 3 years give someone a survival guide to skip a few levels. Or what's my nephew's playing Mario Kart, so I'm just like thinking like that power code, that thing up. Not do that, to not have to face that. Please take it. Take it off me so you can wear it into the office and not go through that. If I can help one person or feel like I'm helping one person, then I'm still helping someone. And that's all I've ever wanted to do my whole life. I was a teacher. I used to babysit, volunteer. One less person has one less war or one less battle. And that gives me a sense of strength and relief. So at the end of the day, when I post my authenticity journey for that day, last night's was some meme about Jasmine and it's like some Aladdin thing. And then when someone has a cure, says they have cure for your incurable illness or something. That's what I was feeling from something. But at least it's out of my head. It's off my heart. And it may sound selfish, but I got peace from it. And that peace is not cheap. And it's hard fought. So if someone gives you the opportunity like you did today, Leah, which I'm so grateful of, think about it, pray about it to whomever you pray for, too. But don't say no right off. Verify who they are. I mean, I checked up. I read the website and things, but leave yourself open to the possibility it could help heal what you're not saying because you're so busy trying to stay alive. 100%. There's peace in talking.
Yes, no, thank you so much, Angela, for your vulnerability, for sharing your insights, your perspectives, for being this open and taking us through the journey of your life from the time you were diagnosed when you were younger to now, and how your life has completely changed and how you've come to be so strong and a powerful patient advocate for those around you.
I'm glad someone sees me as strong.
You are strong, Angela. I can tell you that with everything and the way that you've been speaking and reflecting and seeing this, I think I'm really happy to see how far you've come, and you have so much more yet to go in terms of how many lives you're going to be touching. And you say that healthcare professionals are saving lives, but I think you just speaking and sharing your story is saving lives in and of itself. And I just want to end this, Angela, by saying thank you so much for coming on to the PureMed podcast, for sharing your insights, your perspectives, and for being so open with the Behind Diagnosis Patient Special series. We hope that it sheds light on listening to patient voices, and that over time it will increase health safety, innovation, and transform care delivery in the clinic and beyond. So with this, Angela, thank you so much for coming
on. And thank you. Let me just say, Leah, thank you so much for being a medical student willing to have the conversation. I gained so much hope, and I know I can speak for my mom, that the next generation of doctors is thinking this big and is thinking this open. That's a big deal, what you're doing right now. You invited me to this conversation. So the strength is there. The amount of love you're pouring out to people and the amount of change you're making, you're the change maker. You created the platform. So thank you for inviting me.
Angela, thank you so much for coming on and accepting my invitation. It really means the world to have the opportunity to hear from you firsthand, your experience, your life. Thank you for sharing it with me.
Anytime.
I'd like to thank our sponsors, #RisingYouth, the Government of Canada, Canada Service Corps, and Taking It Global for supporting and funding the project. I'd also like to thank the incredible individuals, voices, and patients who appear on the series and whose stories will guide medical education, clinical practice, and healthcare innovation. Listen in and listen now to the Behind Diagnoses Patient Special Series on the PureMed podcast to ensure change for a better world. Catch us on the next episode in conversation with another incredible patient advocate. And if you need more information, do not hesitate to email us at PureMedFoundation@gmail.com. Thank you for tuning in. Stay safe. Stay healthy.